This is work that was done mostly at Harvard, and I want to acknowledge the team of graduate students who did most of the experiments, and also Leo Kauenhoven, who spent last year visiting our lab and was an integral part of all of these measurements. The material also that we used for these experiments came from three different research groups, and they're kind of intermingled in the talk, but I want to acknowledge the excellent support of these collaborators. And if also, a lot of the work that we'll be talking about, much of it's unpublished, but all of it which is published is available on this website, so you can go there and get PDF versions of all of those papers. Well, it's kind of low. I think, let's see if it's, is it working? Maybe it's not working. Is it working? I was told just to put it in my pocket, and I did what I was told. There's a green light that's on. Yeah, okay, great. This is my normally quiet voice. It's probably not working. So I've reorganized the talk a little bit, and that I want to talk in an effort to make the kind of systems that control spin, the spins in these heterostructured devices will be finding some of their lives spent moving through two-dimensional material, occasionally going through constrictions, and sometimes ending up in little boxes. And so it's useful to understand at least how far we now have pushed an understanding of spin in those devices. And I want to, without going into the story very far, say at least part of our motivation is that our community has been greatly stimulated, I would say, or challenged to produce a new set of phenomena in mesoscopic physics or in nanostructures that involve a level of control and understanding, particularly, it seems, of spin. For instance, if we could control spin sufficiently to produce Einstein-Podolsky-Rosen pairs, then our theorist friends have told us what one might do with such pairs, and so the challenge is upon the experimental community to see how well we can control, and then let that turn into the computer science that will end up being useful. Similarly, from the point of view of quantum computing, it's been shown that a universal quantum computer can be built with a handful of elements. Those elements involve just rotating of a state in which a two-level system of any sort is useful, but also a 2-bit XOR, and the schematic for how one might do that involves, and here the work of Daniel Loss and David DiVincenzo is particularly relevant, involving the spins as well as the locations in a two-level system of some kind of, in a sense, double quantum dot. But understanding how the spins evolve is essential for these to function as a 2-bit gate, and they've described how you can perform certain operations that are what they call a square root of this operation of flipping the spins in order to perform universal computation. So again, if one could do this, then the theory community has told us what we might do with it, and the challenge is really to see how far we can go in controlling spin. So you can imagine some machine in which all of these operations are working perfectly, and you can do some kind of electron spin resonance to control the spins of devices. You could then filter the spins, measure, control, let them flow through two dimensions, let them flow through one dimension, let them be confined in boxes. And if all of this is working right, then one could imagine making a device which actually does something a different way. So let's start in two dimensions. In two dimensions, electron flow isn't particularly relevant to spin physics, except if you work to see the spin physics there. This is a two-dimensional hall bar, essentially, with a gate on top of it. And as most of you have learned, the physics of spin in these materials can be altered by the fact that there's a hetero interface which produces in the frame of the electron a built-in electric field, or that in this material, gallium arsenide, there's a built-in electric field in the crystal, and that so that as electrons move around in this rather clean material, the spin also moves around by virtue of its interaction with both impurities, the walls, and also these built-in electric fields, such that the spin evolves as the motion evolves, and that any kind of quantum interference effect is altered by that spin precession in some kind of spin space while the electron moves around in real space. And when these two mimic each other. It's easy to analyze. Now, if you go and measure the transport of this Hall bar as a function of external magnetic field, this is real data right here. And this is not just a yellow line that was drawn. This is actually a data plot over only 5% of the range. I mean, remember, this goes all the way down to zero. But if you zoom in, this is what it does. But if you zoom in farther, then you can see that in this fifth decimal place is the whole story. So we can feel good about ourselves that we're studying real physics, but you got to remember to not look at this picture, or you start thinking that maybe what you're doing isn't so relevant. But zoomed in pretty far, you can start to see the physics, which teaches you about spin. And that physics involves these quantum interference effects, which take the form of localization and anti-localization. And we have been, in an effort to understand what the spin is doing, playing a lot with how this kind of physics depends on the densities in this material and can tell a long story. Let me go back one second and mention that over the last 15 or so years, the theory of how to extract from these kinds of curves the rates of spin precession, the rates of dephasing, etc., has evolved. This is something like state of the art right now. It's actually an experimental paper, but with lots of theoretical collaborators and a very nice piece of work where you can learn all about not only how to extract these from real data, but a nice introduction to the theory. And I would recommend that paper as a starting point because it also has all the former literature in it. It does have some shortcomings. For instance, it assumes that the spin orbit rate of precession is much slower than the scattering rate, things which are not true in these high mobility header structures, but it is at least state of the art. So if you take those formulas, you can take the data from these two-dimensional electron gases, and you can see that by changing gate voltages from here, slightly negative to slightly positive gate voltages where the density gets higher, you can cross over from a situation in which you have weak localization dominating, and I've only picked three of many traces. You can go farther up and it's then purely weak localization. You can go farther down and it's purely weak anti-localization. But the thing that I want to demonstrate is that this nice work by these two graduate students shows that you can now, with a gate in situ in the cryostat, cross over very nicely from a situation of weak localization to a weak anti-localization. I think in gallium arsenide header structures, this is the first results that I know of along these lines. And so we can control these rates of precession. You'll notice that even though this is a dramatic change in the quantum transport, it's a moderate change in these rates. And I've shown in big letters the kind of cheap version of what this are. Now, this theory has evolved to the point where there's lots of parameters involving different forms of the spin orbit. And so there's all these rates down here. So if anyone really wants to press me on that, all the numbers are here. But just to say that these functional forms have several adjustable parameters corresponding to several different physical processes that have all been kind of rolled into those numbers on the right. Let's now move out of two dimensions, because as these things float around in 2D, they might end up in boxes or constrictions. And there, in order to play with spin, it's very convenient to apply a parallel magnetic field to address predominantly the Zeeman physics, whereas a perpendicular magnetic field addresses, through its flux, the phase of the wave functions. And so we have built a little homemade system where both perpendicular and parallel field can be addressed. The system is simply to mount the sample vertically, and of course you never get it exactly vertically, but you can compensate any absence, any degree of imperfection with a pair of trimming coils that are just formed out of superconducting loops that are strapped onto the side of the inner vacuum can of the dilution refrigerator using dental floss and held in place and then can trim out. It also gives you the ability to both sweep independently perpendicular and parallel magnetic fields, and is a very nice system. So the first and simplest, and maybe what you'd think most boring story in order to study spin physics, would be a system which manifestly doesn't show any spin physics, namely the simple quantum point contact. Here the original data of the Delft group is shown with these plateaus at exactly 2e squared over h, showing that in fact we can think of the levels that are formed by this constriction as being doubly degenerate. So It's a very interesting story, a story that's much more interesting than I think anyone suspected until in 1998, 10 years after this work was done. Mike Pepper's group at Cambridge really drew attention to certain features in these data, which ought to be paid attention to. So let's look at what happens with these data as you turn on a parallel magnetic field. Not surprisingly, in strong parallel magnetic field, the degeneracy of these otherwise degenerate levels is lifted, and you find that a plateau appears at not only 2e squared over h, but at integers of 1, 3, 5 e squared over h in general, and it's a rather straightforward story that the degeneracy has been lifted and now the transport can proceed through one level spin resolved, the second level spin resolved, the third level, etc., and this is in 8 tesla. The interesting observation is that, and the effect, as you'll see, is more striking as the temperature goes up, is that even at 0 tesla, the physics does not become absent of such a feature. And interestingly, the presence of this funny feature, which looks like a little shoulder here, as if it's some hint of what's about to happen in high field, becomes stronger and stronger as the temperature is raised. This is a high temperature phenomenon. And so here, at 0 magnetic field, this shoulder appears to be quite strong. And in fact, if we were to keep going up to 2, 3, 4, 5 Kelvin, every other feature of this quantization would disappear and this would become a diagonal line except for that feature. It's the last one to go. So whatever kind of physics the parallel magnetic field is causing evidently is already present at 0 magnetic field. You can study this another way, the way the Pepper group did, namely to look at the splitting. This is just the derivatives of these curves at high magnetic field. The derivative has two peaks associated with each of these two risers in a minimum in the middle, and then you can see that when they come together at 0 magnetic field, they don't disappear as if whatever is being broken linearly in magnetic field by the external magnetic field appears already broken at 0 field, and the effect becomes stronger as the temperature is raised. This is very surprising and very interesting, but may actually be a tool if it turns out that this is the right story. Because if just in the vicinity of the point contact and nowhere else the degeneracy is lifted, then you can imagine a device in which spin is a non-player everywhere in the problem, except where you want it to be, and namely at the location of a spin filter or a spin detector. And only there, and only in the vicinity of the constriction, does spin become relevant, and so act to maybe allow one spin to go through while reflecting the other spin. It would be nice if at 0 external magnetic field, the object you were interested in behaved as if it was in a considerably larger magnetic field. The story is very rich. These are new and so far unpublished nonlinear transport measurements from our group, comparing again 8 tesla data to 0 tesla data at a couple of different temperatures. It's a sufficiently complicated picture, and we've been looking at it for a long time, that I think it's useful to take it one step at a time. In the zero bias case, the linear transport, you see clearly the plateaus at 1e squared over h, 3e squared over h, 5e squared over h, in addition to the plateau at 2, 4, and 6. Each of these sweeps is for a different gate voltage on the constriction, and these conductances are real. That is, these plots are not offset from each other. They are literally a plateau at 1e squared over h, 2e squared over h, 0.5, etc. So you would say, if you understood what the large magnetic field was doing and that this was a relatively simple story, that this little feature is the feature associated with the lifting of the spin degeneracy. This is its manifestation at zero bias, and these are its wings out at large bias, and that these are evidently connected in some way. When you now look at 0 magnetic field, but at higher temperature, the same features both at high bias and this accumulation point, which is this so-called 0.7 structure, appears in the data. It's quite striking that the clarity of this data is evident at high bias even more clearly than this so-called 0.7 feature. It's also the case that it is not a 0.5, it's higher up. Finally, if you look in any of the data at high bias, it's indistinguishable. You really can't tell the difference between the features at high bias, whether there's an 8 Tesla magnetic field applied or not. The only clue that you're in a high magnetic field is that all of the other subbands have this signature of spin splitting, whereas in the case of zero magnetic field, it only appears in the lowest subband. The story that you would tell might go something like this. And I want to call your attention to several features. At zero bias, you have, for instance, the main plateau located at B is when one spin degenerate mode is passing through the point contact. Here I've indicated that the source and drain are roughly at equal biases, and that the second level is above the Fermi energy so that you only have conduction via this one spin degenerate channel. Now, if you split the two levels with a bias, then the claim is that this looks like the physics of something in a large external magnetic field, and that you better split these two levels into two, and that this plateau is the same plateau you would have seen had you applied a large magnetic field. Now, interestingly, at zero applied bias, there's this large peak in DIDV, which in a sense trumps the 0.7 feature or eliminates the 0.7 feature at low temperature. And so we speculate that, in fact, at low bias, the feature is not there because the degeneracy is not there. That may or may not be true. It may be something, you know, something related to the spin physics which is present is somehow knows just how to trump this feature and produce no 0.7 structure rather than saying eliminating the gap. We don't know, but this is a scenario that fits the data. And then when you go to high bias again over in E, this gap is reopened, as if somehow the system knew that it wasn't allowed to have spontaneously broken symmetry at low bias and at low temperature, but only did it when the system was in some kind of strong transport regime. I think the impression that I want to leave you with is not that we've explained the data in any way. That's not the main message. The main message is this is extremely interesting data and extremely rich and much more complicated than what one would have thought would have happened in a quantum point contact, and maybe even useful. And so we'll try to go on. The models that have been developed, and here I want to call particular attention to Ned Wingreen, and we're working on a paper which include these models, are interesting in the way they succeed in as much as in the way that they don't succeed. At low bias, there's a non-spinful zero bias peak that's associated with a self-screening effect, which describes the data and its temperature dependence rather well. Unfortunately, this peak that is so nice at low conductance has a characteristic feature that it gets wider and wider as you move up toward the first plateau. That's the nature of this self-screening. It becomes less and less significant as you move toward the first plateau. Whereas the experimental data, the zero bias peak remains quite sharp. And in fact, the width of that zero bias feature appears non-monotonic. That is, it grows and grows and grows. Then when it gets to this 0.7 feature, it shrinks again before it goes back up again. That tells us that we may be wrong to seek a single explanation for the zero bias peak down here as up here. It may, for instance, be the self-screening effect proposed by Wingreen down here and some kind of Kondo physics which gives rise to the zero bias peak up here. I don't know, but this curve at least tells us that we mightn't seek the same explanation up here as we do down here. You can ask, if this were Kondo, does it split in a magnetic field, and does it have all of the classic signatures? Well, first of all, it's not the Kondo in quantum dots that we've become familiar with, because there's no quantum dot there. So there's no guarantee that any of the observed phenomena would be the same. But it's interesting to ask the same sets of questions and see how the thing does. The zero bias peak is indeed suppressed by a considerable amount in a parallel magnetic field. In the vicinity of the 0.7 feature, it splits. And above the 0.7 feature, it again doesn't split. The G factor associated with this splitting is some 1.5 times the bare G factor and is a reasonable value. To get a larger view of the whole thing, you can actually look at these IV characteristics, the whole source drain, showing the peak in DIDV. As you move up the plateau toward the first plateau, what happens as you apply first zero external magnetic field? And here you can see the 0.7 feature being trumped by the zero bias peak. And as you turn up the external magnetic field, it's not so much that it splits, it's that the whole curve gets a crease in it. The crease is the valley pushing down to 0.5 on its way to producing a 0.5 feature at high external magnetic field. It's a very complicated story about why this continues to have a zero bias peak while that splits, etc. It's new physics that came out, I think, of a motivation to make spin filters. There's more to the story when you look at the derivatives instead of the actual values, but let me move on for the interest of time to another surprising. I'm going very slowly in terms of difficulty of the experimental situation. Let me only look at one of these objects with not even a dot yet, but just some confined region of electron gas where there are pairs of point contacts. And I'm going to only, in fact, energize two of these. So I'm going to just study the problem of trying to get from one constriction through a 2D gas to another constriction. And we want to build these machines slowly. So let's just say we had a constriction, then you have to fly for a little while, then you have to land somewhere else. And so let's just do that by energizing these two and leaving the other guys turned off. Now, this experiment has been looked at before, two constrictions with a large region in the middle, and it was they called these wide ballistic cavities. That is, it was ballistic between the two point contacts, as it is in our case, and but wide in the sense that you wouldn't worry about this thing actually being a dot. And they found some interesting features that they associated with quantum interference. Now, it wouldn't be quantum interference of a confined box. They didn't have any loops that they could make weak localization about, so they made their own kind of loops and said this is just the backscattering in these kinds of trajectories, even at finite magnetic field. You get these back and forth trajectories trapped between the two sides, and that these cut enough flux that if you put on a magnetic field, you could see a peak in resistance associated with weak localization, etc. We see an even more dramatic version of this if you just energize these two gates and look at zero magnetic field. You find a dip in the conductance. I've turned the picture upside down now, so a peak in resistance is now a dip in conductance, with two very large shoulders on the side, and settling out to a value of 0.5, which would be the expected value if this was at 2e squared over h and 2e squared over h. In units of 2e squared over h, the average should be 1e squared over h. Just resistors in series. You put a resistor, you let it fly, you put another resistor, the average resistance should be two resistors in series, or twice the total resistance, except for this funny business. And now you'd say, well, we can seek explanations for this funny business in terms of quantum interference, etc. But my God, look what happens when you put on a parallel magnetic field. And we know that the parallel magnetic field is parallel because we can trim out any perpendicular component. And it's not just that the picture shifts to the right or left. It's that one peak lives and the other peak dies. And if you put on the other direction of parallel magnetic field, now here up to 3 Tesla, the other peak lives and the first peak dies. I have to confess, I have absolutely no idea what's going on here. The effect is particularly interesting because when you don't offset these peaks and you look at the actual value of conductance, it goes from this 0.5 value, the two resistors in series, almost up to 0.9 in an external magnetic field, meaning something like 90% of what comes in here goes through there if I apply a parallel magnetic field and not if I don't. There appears to be considerable temperature dependence, suggesting that it's a quantum effect, but the area is relatively small so that the trajectories are short. I don't know what a parallel field is doing to this experiment.
Which direction is the parallel field?
It's a way shown. Let me finally, in the last, when am I supposed to stop, Mark? 35? 7-8 more minutes. Let me move to dots finally, and I want to talk about two different kinds of quantum dot situations. One in which the quantum dots are open so that electrons can flow in and out through the quantum point contacts, and that these constrictions may be quantized, but they're at least broadly open. And the other in which you can only enter or exit via tunneling, in which case the familiar Coulomb blockade peaks turn on strongly, and as a function of the external gate voltage, say, applied to this pin, you find quantization of electron number inside of the device. Those quantization values certainly have a strong dependence on, in this case, perpendicular magnetic field, as does the conductance in this case, in which you find these pretty UCF patterns. The first story has to do with what would happen if you were just studying universal conductance fluctuations in these devices, you were looking at how the quantum interference persisted, and you applied a parallel magnetic field. From a phenomenological point of view, the first thing that you see that happens is the conductance fluctuation amplitude decreases. And you might be able to tell yourself a story that you've now broken spin degeneracy. So whereas there used to be pairs of levels that were fluctuating as a function of perpendicular magnetic field, each working in collaboration to increase the fluctuations, they've now been split and they're kind of independently fluctuating, and so there'd be some square root of 2 loss of the amplitude of the fluctuations, or a 2 in the variance. So you might hope that there was a 2 in the variance. The reason that we did this experiment was because we were wondering whether or not there were even pairs of levels inside of quantum dots at all. It wasn't obvious from work that we'd done earlier that levels were paired, and so we thought 2 possibilities. One possibility is it'll decrease by a factor of 2, indicating that we lifted the degeneracy by hand. The other possibility would be no change, indicating that the degeneracy had already been sort of lifted by itself. What we didn't expect was that as a function of magnetic field, the degeneracy should fall by a factor of 4. That wasn't on the menu anywhere. There was no way to explain these large ratios of variances which even went beyond 4. There's a long story about how we gathered all of these statistics and looked at different temperatures. Let me only say that what came out of the experiment was something that was simply not on the menu. Factor of 4 suppression of variance was not in the cards. It's a terrific theoretical community. If you ever discover anything, you just wait around for a little while and then it gets explained, sometimes many times. And so recently, I mean, and this is really within the last month, work from Bert Halperin and co-workers that include Pete Brower, who's here, and also Igor Lehner and Vladimir Falco have addressed this problem and considered a situation in which there is, in addition to kinetic energy, spin orbit of both Rochebaugh and Dresselhaus type, and also Zeeman physics involved, and produced a random matrix theory, and then also, in this paper, goes on to produce a disorder perturbation theory, which has both the average and the variance of the conductance that introduces, it's a very nice result because it expands the kind of formalism that people in random matrix theory had gotten used to, that is, certain universal parameters that we were familiar with, namely this S, which could be 1 or 2, representing the presence or absence of a Kramers degeneracy. There was a beta, which represented the presence or absence of time reversal symmetry. And they recognized the need to introduce a third universality parameter that they called capital sigma, which also took on the values of 1 or 2, which reflected a new symmetry that existed in this kind of Hamiltonian that didn't exist previously. And that in that formulation, they produced a perfectly cogent explanation of why the presence of spin orbit, the same spin orbit that we were seeing in these 2D systems not quite the same, a spin orbit with a different symmetry that results when you, or this sigma represents a different symmetry when you turn on a parallel field and not when you don't. So a very nice paper, and let me just, you know, send you there for the details. An interesting shortcoming of this paper relative to the data was that the spin orbit plus a Zeeman splitting could suppress weak localization. So you might tell yourself this story, which is almost kind of a linguistic derivation, that if you have spin physics from Zeeman and you have spin orbit coupling, then you would destroy orbital symmetry. So you wonder whether or not this linguistic syllogism would actually turn out to be true in the physics. And according to this paper, spin orbit plus spin physics will suppress but not destroy completely weak localization. Whereas when you do the experiment and you consider looking as a function of perpendicular magnetic field and then doing some kind of ensemble averaging over different shapes of the device, this B equals zero data, which clearly shows weak localization, that is a dip in the average conductance at the origin, as you turn on a parallel magnetic field, simply disappears. Not only does the feature at B equals zero, B perp equals zero, disappear, but the symmetry right-left, which is so evident in this picture, is just gone. So again, you would say, well, there's spin orbit plus spin physics would destroy orbital physics, but the analysis of the previous paper says, yes, you would suppress this, but no, you can't destroy it entirely. Happily, there is another paper in the literature, which, in fact, I'm slightly reversing historical order here because this came a bit first, which says that there's another effect of this parallel field, which doesn't have anything to do with spin orbit. Namely, you can literally penetrate with flux the first wave function, even though it's fully quantized out. And you might think, well, yes, it's a certain thickness, and so if I ram some flux through that, I could imagine breaking, I could imagine coupling flux through something. Well, now you have to go actually do the work, and you find that weak localization and conductance fluctuations are indeed sensitive to this flux that goes right through the 2D electron gas, but in a funny way. The characteristic field goes like the sixth power of the applied magnetic field, not linear in magnetic field. So this story can explain the destruction of weak localization and this anti-symmetry in B, something that wasn't explained by the previous analysis, but it can't explain this factor of 4 to 5 reduction in the variance. You might say, well, this looks like a complete story. The shortcoming is that when we do the experiment, all of these phenomena occur together. And so you, am I at zero? Is that a zero you're holding up? Okay, you're being pretty mellow about that, okay. That you need both of these stories to occur not only simultaneously, but on the same external magnetic field scales. It seems a little unlikely, but that may end up being the story. I wanted to say just a word about spins in closed devices, and that story is that we had seen previously, actually, let me go back one slide. We'd seen previously that looking at the orbital magneto fingerprints of Coulomb blockade told us that spin degeneracy was not obviously present. That is, that the level splittings apparently due to exchange or even some kind of interaction effect destroyed the appearance of paired levels. Not always. Sometimes you found that subsequent Coulomb blockade peaks had the same orbital structure as if they were going into the same orbital level, even and odd, but very often subsequent guys didn't have the same story. So you have to end up telling a story in which there's some ground state spin which is non-zero, even in the absence of an external magnetic field. Pete Brouwer with Yuval Oreg and Bert Halperin calculated these distributions. These are in the presence of interactions. As you move up in interaction strength, you find ground state spins that span a large range. I want only to end with the idea that we can do these similar parallel field experiments now in the Coulomb blockade regime, and what you find is a very straight spin story in which the levels rise and fall and rise, and sometimes rise again twice, indicating a non-zero buildup of spin. And if you go back and assign some reasonable values that are consistent with these rising and falling, you find that there are often occurrences of ground state spin 1 in these devices. These are the slopes of the lines that you'd expect in a parallel magnetic field with no adjustable parameters. So this is just using the bare G factor of gallium arsenide 0.44 would give those kinds of slopes. And it's interesting to see that here, if you look at the spacing between peaks, they break up into three groups, not two, indicating rather than filling the dot with spin zero, spin a half, spin zero, spin a half, spin zero, spin a half, as you add even, odd number of electrons. Occasionally you find a buildup of spin that's represented by the ones that go in the straight line because it's going the same direction twice. But I want to at least mention that this holy grail of measuring single spin physics is not such a holy grail, either that or we found the holy grail, because it's actually not so hard to do in quantum dots. But we have to now be careful about all kinds of the bugaboos that I mentioned earlier about how these things go. You can go to higher field, comparing theory. This is Richard Berkowitz and Boris Altshuler, some theory of how these levels should move compared to the experiments, and you really can see single spin physics. So let me conclude. In two dimensions, so to make these kinds of devices that we're going to need to make, if we are ever successful in making them, we need to move things around, have them go between constrictions, end up in boxes, and generally get steered. So we need to understand all of these domains. In two dimensions, some kind of gate-controlled spin orbit effect was demonstrated, I believe, for the first time in gallium arsenide two-dimensional electron gases. In one dimension, we looked at this very interesting 0.7 feature in quantum point contacts, where we found the zero bias peak along with the spin physics, which is evident. And finally, in quantum dots, we found that an in-plane magnetic field introduces a novel spin orbit-like effect that affects these quantum coherence features. And in closed dots, these single transitions are single spin transitions are readily observed. Thank you.
Okay, we have time for questions.
The 0.7 feature happens in all materials, as far as I know, at 0.7.
I don't know that it's ever been measured in anything other than a gallium arsenide heterostructure.
Materials.
Oh, yeah, around the world.
Groups around the world.
Around the world.
Whereas all that you discussed indicated that it should be somewhere between 0.5 and 1.
I guess I would say the following. Probably saying that it appears somewhere between 0.6 and 0.8 pretty much covers everywhere in the world. There was some story about very long wires where it sank down to 0.5, but those were rather anomalous devices and may have another explanation. I think that everyone would agree that it's above 0.5 and below 1 and in this relatively narrow band. You mean for me to get 10,000 peaks instead of 9 of them? Yeah, I know, it'd be more interesting. No, Yoram, I have some disappointing news for you, which is these are all the data that we have so far. You better believe, which is why it's published in some, you know, Physica Scripta, like, you know, you can't even find it anywhere. Right, yeah. But this was for us, rather than being a final result, a proof to ourselves that we can do this measurement. And now you better believe that we are interested in understanding how often this occurs, how often that occurs, how often that occurs, what are the incidences of all of these. In these restricted set of data, we didn't see a spin 3/2. I think that we do find some consistency with these predictions. That is, the prevalence of spin 1 relative to spin 0, we're measuring out here, should be much more common to see spin 1 relative to spin 0 than it would be to see spin 3/2 relative to 1/2. That is, it's not the same to say 3/2 relative to 1/2 is about the same distribution as 1 relative to 0. It's not the case, at least insofar as this calculation captures the... You don't mean going from 0 to 3/2. You mean going 0 to 1, 1 to 3. Yeah. Okay. Fine. Well. Okay. I mean, whether it's trivial. I mean, you're tell Pete it's trivial. Yeah. Okay. It's a hard experiment. And we'll do. Okay, so you're on. For me, the announcement is that single spins can be measured. Okay, chapter 2 later will be what the statistic story is, if that's the direction we want to go. The story for today is that single spins can be measured.
Charlie, that 0.7 structure, you told the story that as you increase the parallel field, point to data, I would rather say that the 0.7 structure is something that exists and gets swamped by the spin split subband, but could actually be completely unrelated to it.
Again, we're all models are now, subject to, I look at the data, I tell a story. I think that the nice thing is that there's a huge amount of data now, because each group around the world, from Pepper's group, from the Copenhagen group, really see essentially the same kind of results. And there are models that are very detailed, which say that the feature should be at 0.75 and go up to 0.875, and really have taken these numbers quite seriously and are detailed. I refer to the work of Henrik Bruce and co-workers, maybe they have it. But there are some details that affect how this works. But essentially, all the groups see the same kind of data. Yeah.
You mentioned the self-screening effect. You mean actually the runoff effect?
You want to help me out here. Do I mean that?
For the zero bias.
For the zero bias. This is a numerical result. Okay, so he's the right guy to answer that rather than me. I mean, this is Ned Wingreen's numerical result rather than mine. But density of states. I think it's a density of states effect that simply, as you start to fill this thing up, you can get screening at zero bias because both channels can contribute to some kind of screening. Whereas if you're like this, then they don't. Okay, so I think that it's a straightforward effect, but I don't know to what extent it is or isn't related to. I don't know, Leonia. It's a conductance peak, not a resistance peak. It's a conductance peak.
And it's hard to get
Well, it is, and it is suppressed, but it's the wrong sign for that. Okay, yeah.
Okay, well, let's thank Charlie again.